This is The New Criterion. I'm James Panero, Executive Editor. My guest today is Joshua T. Katz. Josh is a classicist, a champion of open discourse on campus, and a visiting critic of The New Criterion. He is also a friend, and I'm grateful he now joins us in the editorial offices for this special edition of the podcast. Josh, welcome.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
Last month, Josh delivered The New Criterion's fourth annual Circle Lecture. We inaugurated this live lecture series as a way of recognizing the magazine's full circle of supporters. Listeners, consider joining our circle if you haven't done so already, with an annual donation of just $100 or more. Your support underwrites initiatives such as our Visiting Critic Program, the Hilton Kramer Fellowship, and the true costs of the magazine's production. I should add that the Circle also brings us together for these wonderful events. To learn more, visit newcriterion.com/circle. The title of Josh's talk is The Beginnings: First Words, First Lines, First Stories. The talk will appear as the lead feature in our November 2022 issue. Josh, after hearing your talk, maybe I should enunciate your title a little bit differently. Rather than The Beginnings, perhaps The Beginnings is more appropriate, since you enumerate the frequent use of the word the at the beginning of sentences, articles, and titles in the pages of The New Criterion, which, as you point out, is another the construction. It's something I've never thought much about, but you have thought about it a great deal, and now we all will, too. What does it mean that even in our own pages, the articles mostly start with articles, and our beginnings are the beginnings?
Well, the first thing to say is that the structure of English promotes this sort of thing. So if you think about the way any sentence begins, never mind the very first sentence of a story or an article or a book, you're going to see that the words are very boring ones. There are going to be lots of words like the and a and an. There are going to be lots of prepositions like to and for and in and on. There are going to be lots of, well, what I call little words. This might not seem a terribly interesting thing, but on the other hand, we really do care about first sentences. People know first sentences. Even people without really great education tend to be able to quote first lines, but not second lines. And so what is it that makes these first lines special? Well, whatever it is, it isn't that first word, or very rarely so.
Now, of course, there are no such articles in Latin, an inflected language where meaning is encoded in word endings. Latin poetry and prose can do more than English with word location, and do it more concisely. As a classicist, what is your view of our modern language, with all the parts we have acquired from Anglo-Saxon and elsewhere, and the preponderance of these monosyllabic function words? Has something been lost?
No, I wouldn't say that anything has been lost. Different languages are good at different things. If you want to play around with word order in English, you can do that, but in most genres, you can only do that to a certain extent. Otherwise, you end up with word salad. In Latin, as you were just pointing out or alluding to, you can do that a lot more, but, well, English can do other things. Just because a lot of sentences in English begin with it was, for example, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, it was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness, etc. Just because lots of sentences begin like that, it was a dark and stormy night, etc., 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 doesn't make those less good sentences, doesn't make them even, in a way, less creative sentences. It's just that they're doing something different.
Yes, of course. And if you mess around with word order too much in English, you sound like Yoda from Star Wars.
You do sound like Yoda. As I pointed out, I do not now mean in any way to criticize the poetry section of The New Criterion or poetry in general. But I did point out, though I didn't elaborate on this, I do have pages of notes on it, but I did point out that the poems in the New Criterion, and indeed poems in general, behave somewhat differently from the rest of the issue, and indeed the rest of what one would call established prose. It doesn't mean you can't begin a poem with a word like the, or in, or for, or a. Of course you can, but, well, the poem in the September 2022 issue of the New Criterion begins with the word candle flickered. It's pretty well guaranteed that now somebody's going to go and find it, but probably no essay, book, or story in the history of the English language has ever begun with the word candle flickered. It's harder to do.
You make the point that even many of our great English novelists, as you say, resort to function words for their beginnings, with some notable exceptions. Herman Melville's Call Me Ishmael or Zora Neale Hurston's Ships at a Distance have every man's wish on board. In fact, in English, it is difficult to avoid such function beginnings. The use of plural nouns or proper names or imperative verbs are some of the only ways around it. My question is, should we bother? Or is English prose fine just being prosaic?
Well, prosaic is a negative adjective, but prose, I would say, is not a negative noun. So I guess I would like to say that being prosaic in this sense isn't a bad thing at all. In fact, if you start writing prose in a non-prosaic way, then, well, this is, I guess, is a larger philosophical question, but either it stops being prose, stops being prosaic in that sense, or it's just odd.
I want to turn for a moment to a very different piece you wrote for our October 2022 issue. The title of this piece is De la musique avant toute chose, and there are no the beginnings in that title.
No, but it does begin with de, and its second word is la, so it takes the third word until you get to something interesting.
Very true.
Welcome to French.
The subject is Edward Lippmann, a family piano, and growing up with the brilliant but troubled son of the New Criterion's founding publisher, Samuel Lippmann. This is a personal piece and a heartbreaking story. As you say, Edward was special, and it is up to you to recall him for the world. In one passage I particularly liked, you describe yourselves together as an odd pair of bookish West Side boys who roamed around New York eating breakfast at a greasy spoon on Broadway before taking the bus together to school, carting home shopping bags full of books from the Strand and used records from Academy Records after school, and drinking sidecars at the Carlisle's Bemelman's Bar. Many a happy evening. That's a great image. And what was it like growing up with the Lippmanns in the early days of the New Criterion? And what happened to Edward?
Well, there's a lot to say there. Edward was my best friend for the last 3 years of school. And we remained close after graduating too, though we went to different colleges. I went to Yale, he went to Columbia, but then we went to England together. He went to Cambridge and I went to Oxford. But soon thereafter, his father, who had been diagnosed with leukemia a few years before, that's Sam Lippmann, the founding publisher of the New Criterion, a few years later, Sam died. And really, his death, and indeed the years leading up to his death, led to a terrible decline of Edward. He took it very badly. I mean, I'm not a doctor. It's impossible for me to know whether the schizophrenia and or whatever else he had would have come on or would have come on in the same way and would have had the same effect had Sam not died. It's just impossible to know that. But his last years were pretty awful. But the years before that, well, yes, we were a pair of odd West Side boys at a fancy East Side school. We cared a lot about books. We cared a lot about music. We were at the Strand all the time. We would cart the books back and Sam would inspect them and decide that we shouldn't have spent 99 cents on that book. You'll remember those old Strand, colorful Strand stickers on inexpensive books. And Sam would say, you know, we already have this, or we already have much more likely 6 copies of this, the first edition, the second edition, the third edition, etc. Or he would say, that's a really good find. We would this is the day of the record. We would go to Academy Records and we would buy stacks and stacks and stacks of things. And once again, we would go back and Sam and Edward's mother, Janine, would say, oh, well, that's a really good recording, or that's a really lousy recording, or why are you buying this? We already have two copies of this, and so on and so forth. It was a real education. And the beginning years of the New Criterion, I mean, they must have been marvelous. I watched that from a small distance. I wasn't in the office. I mean, we would go and visit Sam once in a while in the old offices. But fundamentally, I watched that at a distance through Edward and through his parents at home and through the many phenomenal guests that they would have at the parties that they threw in their really lovely apartment on Riverside Drive. It was a great time. New York then was very different from New York now. It's hard to imagine in these days of parenting and the way New York is now that most people would allow their kids, even responsible teenagers, to roam around the way we did, but we sure did.
And music was a recurring motif.
Oh, music was absolutely a recurring motif. I mean, Sam had been a piano prodigy. Janine had been the assistant of Rosina Levine at Juilliard and was a very well-respected piano teacher on her own in the years in which I knew them. They had two Steinway grands in the living room. They had a third piano in Sam's study. Music was on and or being played all the time.
And you mentioned that it was at Bemelman's Bar that you would often retire for sidecars, and you have become a collector of Bemelmans, isn't that right?
I have indeed, and that was, in fact, through Edward. Originally, it was, and still, it is largely not the things for which he is most famous, namely the Madeline series. I mean, I'm interested in those, too, and I have, I think, I have five original Madeline paintings and watercolors. But on top of that, I've got a lot of first editions. I have a lot of drawings. I have a lot of ephemera. And all of that was because of Edward, who I think was probably the one who first introduced me to the Bemelman's Bar. I'm not absolutely sure that I'd never been there before him, but I certainly was there an awful lot with him. We were, of course, underage. We were responsible. Nobody cared.
Well, and that's right. And beyond the Madeline stories, there's the Hotel Bemelmans and all his great writing about growing up in those establishments. And he did the illustrations at Bemelman's Bar in lieu of payment?
Is that I believe story? That's correct. He did it in lieu of payment. He had a, I think, not terribly savory life in reality, but on the page, boy, was his life wonderful. If you want to read things about food and travel and music and women with long flowing gowns and men with funny hats, he's your man.
Josh, it wasn't so long ago that we were eating oysters together and talking about Scotch whiskey with few other cares in the world. It was around the same time that your future wife, Solveig Gold, was working for the summer as my colleague at New Criterion. Now you two together are the celebrated champions of free discourse on campus and scourges of woke politics everywhere, especially as it relates to the study of the classics. It all started with a Declaration of Independence by a Princeton professor, an essay he wrote for Quillette, in the heat of that annus horribilis of 2020. Were you surprised by the response your piece received?
Well, can I back up? Actually, I think you have that wrong. A great deal of it began in the New Criterion in 2017, when Solveig, who had just graduated from Princeton and with whom I was not yet involved, wrote a piece for the website.
It was, you're right. Yeah,
for the website called The Colorblind Bard, I believe. And that piece did very well, in one sense of doing very well. And
I would say it still does well. It still gets a lot of traffic.
Yeah, well, she's a good writer. There are many reasons I married her, one of which is that. But in any case, that piece ignited a real firestorm. So in a way, I married into the firestorm. I myself didn't become, I think, controversial in any interesting way for another 3 years. Mm-hmm. So back to your question, if you want, but I think you're underselling the role of the New Criterion here. I'm very proud of what she wrote, and I'm very proud of the response that she wrote, which you also published, to a response that one of my former colleagues wrote to her original.
That's
a little
right.
complicated. She wrote something, a response by one of my former colleagues at Princeton, one of my then colleagues, now former colleagues, and then she responded to that.
That's right. We had a whole exchange. Fascinating. I didn't expect such cancellations to come out of what seemed like a friendly discussion.
Neither did I, but it turns out that I'm not a good prognosticator.
Well, I'm delighted to say that your appointment as our visiting critic continues through our current publishing season to June 2023. What are you considering next for our pages?
Well, I'm not sure what's going to be next. One possibility, and certainly it will appear somewhere, so maybe in these pages, will be a paper about pronouns. I gave a talk at Harvard last week to the Department of Government, Harvey Mansfield's program on constitutional government, called Names, Pronouns, and the Law. I don't know as much about the law as I ought to, but on the other hand, you can't have had my experiences of the past few years and not have picked up a thing or two and be interested. And as for pronouns, well, you know, it's a funny thing, but many years ago, almost 25 years ago, I wrote a PhD dissertation at Harvard in the Department of Linguistics on pronouns. The topic of that was very, very different from what people mean when they talk about pronouns today. But the fact is that until a very few years ago, I could give lectures to audiences of what one might call normal people, not academics. And I would say, as a gambit, well, I wrote my dissertation on pronouns, and the audience would laugh hysterically. It was a wonderful, wonderful line. Well, nobody is laughing now if you say I wrote something about pronouns. So I thought it was time to return to that subject, but in a very, very different way, and talk about neo-pronouns and trans rights and that sort of thing. So perhaps that will appear in an issue soon. We'll see.
That's right. Like much else, I would have been a bad prognosticator if I thought that pronouns were ever going to get political. It seems about as apolitical as you could be.
That's right. Next up will be the word "the" is political. As you can see, and I hadn't actually quite honestly thought very much about this before a few seconds ago, but if I now write about pronouns, then I will have published a couple of pieces on what one might have thought were the most boring words in English. Now people don't think pronouns are boring at all, and I hope in the piece that is about to appear in the November issue that you will discover that words like "the" and "it" and "to" aren't actually as boring as one might think either.
Well, yeah, so that's good and bad if "the" becomes the next hot political hotspot.
Well, it can't be worse than Zur.
Well, you've been listening to The New Criterion. I'm James Panero. My guest today is Joshua T. Katz, visiting critic of The New Criterion. Josh's talk, The Beginnings, First Words, First Lines, First Stories, our fourth annual Circle Lecture, appears in the November 2022 issue of the magazine. For more, visit newcriterion.com/circle. Josh, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to be associated with The New Criterion. It's been a long time coming, thanks to the Lippmans, and now it's even official. Mm-hmm.